He mean to punish Matthias at the risk of his own life? I said nothing, hoping she would spew her shock and alarm and be done with it. Have you spoken to Judas? Did you put him up to this? No, I said too quickly. I had an outstanding talent for committing deceit, but none for hiding it. She slapped me hard across my cheek. Matthias should never have let you leave the house. There will be no more walking the hillsides with Lavi. You will remain at home until the betrothal ceremony. If there's a ceremony, I said, and she lifted her hand and struck my other cheek. 22. That evening, as the day spilled the last of its pale lights over the valley, Yaltha and I took once more to the roof. On my cheeks were the rouged imprints of my mother's hand. Yaltha brushed her fingertip over them. She said, "Did Judas tell you he intended to burn Nathaniel's grove? Did you know?" He swore to do his part to end my betrothal, but I didn't think he would go so far as this. I lowered my voice. "I'm glad he did." The first chill of the season had arrived. Her shoulders were hunched up like bird wings. She drew her scarf around them. "Tell me, how does destroying Nathaniel's dates help your cause?" When I described the bargain between father and Nathaniel, she said, "I see. By causing your father to lose favor with Antipas, Judas wagers Nathaniel will end the agreement." "Yes, it's cunning." For the first time, I tasted hope on the back of my tongue. Then I swallowed, and it was gone. I thought of the prayer in my bowl, of my face inside the tiny sun. I'd cleaved to them as things that might somehow save me, and yet doubts repeatedly consumed them. Frantic for reassurance, I told her about the vision I'd had of my face. "Do you believe it's a sign I'll avoid this marriage and realize my hopes?" I waited. The moon shone bright. The rooftop, the sky, and the houses nestled tightly across the city seemed made of glass. "How can we know the ways of God?" she answered. Her skepticism showed not only in the evasiveness of her words, but in the way her mouth twitched with words she didn't say. I persisted. "But a vision such as this can't mean I'm fated to disappear into Nathaniel's house to live out my days in misery. It must be a promise of some kind." She turned the force of her eyes on me. I watched them gather into small brown cruxes. "Your vision means what you want it to mean. It will mean what you make it to mean." I stared at her, baffled, perturbed. "Why would God send me a vision if it has no meaning other than what I give to it? What if the point of his sending it is to make you search yourself for the answer?" Such uncertainty, such unpredictability. "But Aunt," it was all my lips could manage. Could we know the ways of God or not? Did he possess an intention for us, his people, as our religion believed, or was it up to us to invent meaning for ourselves? Perhaps nothing was as I'd thought. Overhead, the black magnitude, the shining, breakable world. Yaltha had made a crack in my certainty about God and his workings. I felt it give way, and a crevasse open. 23. When there were two ivory chips remaining on my reckoning cloth, Lavi and I slipped from the house, despite Mother's decree, and made our way to the cave where I'd buried my possessions. The sky was in a sunken mood, grayed and heavy and windstruck. Lavi had pled with me not to venture out. But knowing he put large measure in dreams and omens, I told him I'd dreamed a hyena dug up my belongings, and I was compelled to go to the cave and reassure myself they were still safely concealed. It was a shameless fabrication. It was true I worried about my writings and my bowl, but that was not the reason for my lie. I hoped to find Jesus. Arriving at the same hour that I'd found him praying before, I wandered about the little clearing, peering over the outcrops of rock, then searching the cave. There was no trace of him. After making a display of inspecting my burial spot, I stood with Lavi just inside the cave, studying the heavens. The sun had tunneled so far into the clouds, the world had blackened. "We should go back," Lavi said. "Now." He'd brought a small rolled canopy of thatched palm to protect us if the rains began. I watched as he unfurled it. I had an awful feeling inside, something sad and sodden like the sky. He was right. We should leave. Once the rains began, they would not let up, perhaps for hours. I pulled my mantle over my head, then lifted my eyes toward the balsam grove. And there he was, moving through the trees. He stepped quickly, glancing upward, his tunic a smear of white in the murky light. Drops of rain began to fall. They splatted on the limestone, the treetops, the hard shell earth, sending up the smell of fertility. As he broke into a run, I stepped back into the shadows. Lavi, seeing him, tensed, setting his jaw. I said, "He's of no danger to us. He's known to me." "And did you have a dream of his coming, too?" Within seconds, the rain became a swarm of locusts, thick and deafening. Jesus bolted into the cave as if coming up out of the sea, his clothes dripping, his hair hanging in dark, wet tendrils on his cheeks, his leather belt jangled with tools. Seeing us, he started. "May I share your refuge, or would you have me seek shelter elsewhere?" "The hillsides belong to everyone," I answered, pulling the mantle back from my head. "Even if that were not true, I wouldn't be so cruel as to send you back into the rainstorm." Recognition broke across his face. His eyes drifted to my feet. "You are no longer lame?" I smiled at him. "No, and you, I trust, were not arrested by Herod Antipas's soldier." His smile was a broad, crooked arrangement on his face. "No, I was faster than he was." Thunder cracked over our heads. Whenever the sky quaked, women uttered a blessing. "Lord, preserve me from the wrath of Lilith." But I could never bring myself to say it. I would whisper instead, "Lord, bless the roaring," and that was what rose now to my lips. He greeted Lavi, "Shilama." Lavi muttered the greeting back, then moved some distance away to the cave wall, where he sank onto his haunches. His surliness surprised me. He was piqued that I'd lied about the hyena, that I'd spoken to a strange man, that I dragged him here at all. "He's my servant," I said, then immediately regretted drawing attention to the difference in our stations. "His name is Lavi," I added, hoping to sound less supercilious, "and I am Anna." "I'm Jesus ben Joseph," he replied, and a disturbance of some kind passed over his face. I didn't know if it was because I'd appeared arrogant, or due to the oddity that we should meet again, or something in the utterance of his name. "I'm glad our paths crossed," I said. "I've wished to thank you for your kindness in the market. You weren't rewarded very well for it. I hope your head wasn't hurt badly." "It was little more than a scratch," he smiled and rubbed his forehead. Tiny droplets sheened his brow. He dried them with his cloak, then rubbed the wool over his hair, leaving the locks askew, sprigs everywhere. He looked boyish, and I felt the same hot whirring in my breast as before. He stepped deeper into the cave, away from the mist and nearer to where I stood. "You're a stonemason?" I asked. He touched the awl that dangled from his belt. "My father was a carpenter and a stonemason. I took up his trade." Grief flared in his face, and I guessed that speaking the name Joseph moments ago had caused the shadow to enter his eyes. It was for his father he'd prayed to the Kaddish that day. "Did you think me to be a yarn sorter?" he asked, quick to cover his sadness with wit. "You did seem adept at it." My tone was teasing, and I saw a ripple of the smile I'd observed earlier. "I go with my sister Salome to the market when there's no work of my own to be had. I've become an expert with yarn from too much practice. My brother's even more so. They're the ones who usually accompany her. We don't let her cross the valley alone."
"You come from Nazareth, then?"
"Yes. I make door lintels, roof beams, and furniture, but my work doesn't rival my father's. There have been few commissions for me there since he died. I'm compelled to come to Sepphoris now to be hired as one of Herod Antipas's laborers."
How was it he spoke so freely? I was female, a stranger, the daughter of a wealthy Roman sympathizer, yet he didn't hold himself apart.
His eyes swept over the cave. I sometimes stop to pray here on my way. It's a lonely place, except today. He laughed, the soaring sound I'd heard in the market, and it caused me to laugh as well. Do you labor on Herod Antipas's amphitheater? I asked. I cut stone for it in the quarry. When quotas are reached and hiring ceases, I travel to Capernaum and join a band of fishermen on the Sea of Galilee and sell my portion of the catch. You are many things, then. A carpenter, a stonemason, a yarn sorter, and a fisherman. I'm all of those, he said, but I belong to none of them. I wondered if, like me, he possessed a longing for something forbidden to him, but I didn't ask for fear of probing too far. Instead, I thought of Judas and said, You don't mind working for Antipas? I mind my family's hunger more. It falls on you to feed your sister and brothers? And mother, he added. He did not say wife. He spread his damp cloak on the ground and gestured for me to sit. As I did so, I looked at Lavi, who appeared to sleep. Jesus sat down at a discreet distance, cross-legged, facing the cave opening. For a long interval, we watched the rain and the wild, untethered sky without speaking. The nearness of him, his breathing, the way everything I felt inhabited me. I found rapture in these things, in this being together in the lonely place, and all around the thundering world. He broke the silence by asking about my family. I told him my father had come from Alexandria to serve Herod Antipas as head scribe and counselor, that my mother was the daughter of a cloth merchant in Jerusalem. I confessed I would be beset with loneliness if not for my aunt. I didn't mention that my brother was a fugitive, or that the disagreeable man he'd seen with me in the market was now my betrothed. I wanted so badly to tell him my writings were buried not far from where he sat, that I was a student, an ink-maker, a composer of words, a collector of forgotten stories. But I kept these things inside, too. What brought you outside of the city on the day the rains begin? He wanted to know. I could not say, you. The reason is you. I walk often in the hills, I told him. This morning I was impetuous, believing the rains would not arrive so soon. It was at least a partial truth. And you? Did you come here to pray? If so, I fear I've kept you from it. I don't mind. I doubt God does either. Lately I've been poor company for him. I bring him nothing but questions and doubts. I thought of my conversation with Yalfa on the roof and the doubts about God that had assailed me ever since. I don't think doubts are wrong if they are honest, I said quietly. He turned his face to mine and his eyes felt different on me. Was it a revelation to him that a girl would presume to instruct a devout Jewish man on the vagaries of devotion? Had he caught a glimpse of me, Anna, the girl at the bottom of the incantation bowl? His belly groaned. He pulled a pouch from the pocket in his sleeve and removed a flatbread. He broke it into three even pieces and offered a portion to me and the other to Lavi, who had woken. You would break bread with a woman and a Gentile? I said. With friends, he answered, offering me his uneven grin. I allowed myself to smile back and felt something tacit pass between us. The first tiny sprout of our belonging. We ate our bread. I remember the taste of barley and peasantry in my mouth, the sadness that came to me as the rain lessened. He walked to the opening and looked at the sky. The foreman at the quarry will be hiring laborers soon. I must go. May this meeting not be our last, I said. May God will it yet again. I watched him hurry away through the balsam grove. I would never tell him that our meeting in the cave that day was not by chance. I would not reveal I'd seen him there once before as he'd prayed. To the very end, I would let him believe God's hand was in our meeting. Who's to say? Yaltha's words remain with me. How can we know the ways of God? 24. I entered the palace bedecked and perfumed, henna vines on my arms, kohl beneath my eyes, ivory bracelets on my wrists, and silver anklets at my feet. On my head I wore a gold-leaf coronet that that was woven intricately into the braids of my hair. My betrothal dress was adorned with 24 ornaments, every precious stone commanded by scripture. Mother had hired the finest seamstress in Sepphoris to sew the gems along the purple bands on my neck and sleeves. I was laden down and sweating like a donkey. We mounted the steps to Herod Antipas's great hall beneath a wind-ravaged canopy held aloft by four servants who strained to keep it from flying away. My betrothal ceremony had arrived on a day full of rain and drear. I followed behind my parents, stumbling up the wide stone stairs, holding on to Yaltha's arm. My aunt had seen to it that I drank a full cup of undiluted wine before setting out, which had caused the edges of things to grow furred, and my distress to shrink into something small and mewling. 2 days ago, when Lavi and I had returned from the cave, Mother had met us at the gate with typical fury. Poor Lavi was sent straight to the rooftop to scour away the plenitude of bird droppings. She restricted me again to my room, warning my aunt to keep her distance. Undeterred, Yaltha came to me late in the nights with cups of wine and dates, and listened to my tale of meeting Jesus. I'd found no rest since seeing him, and whenever I fell asleep, I dreamed of him coming through the rain. In the great hall, torches were mounted on the columns, and the walls were lavishly frescoed with fruits and flowers and twisting ropes. A mosaic covered a vast portion of the floor, tiny bits of white marble, black pumice, and blue grass arranged into magnificent creatures. Fishes, dolphins, whales, and sea dragons. Looking down, I saw that I stood upon a large fish swallowing a small one. I could almost feel its tail swish. I tried hard not to be awed, but it was impossible. Wined and dazed, I moved across the mosaics as if walking upon water. Only later would it occur to me that Herod Antipas, a Jew, had broken God's second commandment with a flamboyance that drew my breath. He'd made a sea of graven images. Father had once said our tetrarch was schooled in Rome and spent years gorging on the city. Now he imitated that world within his palace, a hidden shrine to Rome that the devout, common Jew would never see. Mother appeared at my elbow. You will wait for the ceremony in the royal apartments. You must not be seen by Nathaniel until it's time. It will not be long. She made a motion with her hand, and a silver-haired woman led me along a portico, past the wing of Roman baths, then up a second flight of stairs into a bedchamber, without fresco or mosaic, but paneled with the golden wood of the terebinth tree.
So, you are the lamb to be sacrificed, a voice said in Greek.
Turning, I saw a dark-skinned, wraith-like woman standing beside a grand bed that was swathed in jewel-colored silks. Her black hair cascaded down her back like a spill of ink. It had to be Phasaelus, Antipas's wife. All of Galilee and Perea knew that her father, Aretas, king of the Nabataeans, had conspired with Herod Antipas's father to arrange their marriage as a way to stop skirmishes along their common border. It was said that upon learning her fate, Phasaelus, only 13 at the time, cut her arms and wrists and cried for 3 days and 3 nights. The shock of her presence in the room left me momentarily mute. She was dazzling, standing there in her scarlet dress and golden mantle, but pitiable, too, her life turned into a ploy by two men.
Are you capable of speaking Greek, or are you simply too docile to answer me?
Her tone was scoffing, as if I were an object of amusement to her. Phasaelus's rebuke was a slap, and it was like waking. A feeling of loss and wrath rose in me. I wanted to shout at her. I am betrothed to someone I despise, and who despises me in return. I have little hope I will see the man I love ever again. I don't know what has become of my brother. Words are life to me, yet my writings are buried in the ground. My heart is sickled like wheat tares, and you speak to me as if I am weak and imbecilic. I did not care if she possessed the stature of a queen. I thundered at her.
I am no lamb.
A flash in her eyes. No, I see you're not.
You heap condescension on me, but we are no different, you and I.
A sneer slid into her voice. Inform me, please. How are we no different? You were forced to marry as I am now forced. Were not each of us used by our fathers for their own selfish purposes? We are both wares to be traded. She walked toward me and her scent floated out, nard and cinnamon. Her hair swayed, her hips oscillated. I thought of the lurid dance my mother had seen her perform. How I would have loved to see it. I feared she was coming to slap me for my insolence, but I saw her eyes had softened. She said, "When I last saw my father, 17 years ago, he wept bitterly and begged forgiveness for sending me to this wasteland. He told me it was for a noble reason, but I spit on the floor before him. I cannot forget he loved his kingdom more than me. He married me to a jackal." I saw the difference then. Her father had traded her for peace. My father had traded me for greed. She smiled, and I saw this time there was no guile in it. "We shall be friends," she said, taking my hand, "not because of our fathers or our shared misfortune. We shall be friends because you are no lamb, and I too am no lamb." Phasaelis leaned her head to my ear. "When your betrothed repeats the blessings, do not look at him. Do not look at your father. Look to yourself." We stood in the torch-dark light atop the watery mosaic. My parents, Yaltha, Herod Antipas, Phasaelis, Rabbi Shimon ben Yohai, Nathaniel and his sister Zophar, and at least 2 dozen other extravagantly coiffed people I could not name and did not care to. I planted my toes upon the scaly back of a fierce-eyed sea dragon. I'd never seen Antipas up close. He seemed the age of my father, but heavier, with a belly that protruded. His hair was oiled and fell about his ears from beneath a strange crown that resembled an upside-down, gold-plated stew pot. He wore bracelets and silver circlets in his ears, and his eyes were too small for his face, as small as date pits. I thought him repulsive. The old rabbi recited the Torah, "It is not good for man to be alone," and then spoke the rabbinic teachings. "A man without a wife is not a man. A man without a wife establishes no household. A man without a wife has no progeny. A man without a wife, household, and children does not live as God ordained. Man's duty is to marry." His voice was perfunctory and tired. I did not look at him. My father read the betrothal contract, which was followed by a token payment of the bride price, passed ceremoniously from Nathaniel's hand to his. I did not look at them. "Do you attest to your daughter's virginity?" the rabbi asked. My head jerked up. Would they now make the pink-brown folds between my legs their business? Nathaniel leered, a reminder of the miseries that lay in store for me in the bedchamber. Father anointed the rabbi with oil as a sign of my purity. All of this I watched. I wanted them to witness the contempt shining on my face. I cannot record how Nathaniel looked as he read the groom's blessings, for I refused to offer him even a glance. I stared at the mosaic, imagining myself far away beneath the sea. I am no lamb. I am no lamb. In the banqueting hall, Herod Antipas reclined on a luxurious couch, propped on his left elbow. He sat behind the center table of the triclinium while everyone waited to see who would be seated to his right and left, and who would be escorted to the sad little couches at the far ends of the tables. The only true and precise measure of the Tetrarch's favor was how near to him one was seated. We women, Phasaelis among us, were gathered at a separate table altogether, farther away than the hapless and wretched persons who would soon find themselves consigned to the distant seats. Here we would be served the less fine dishes and the poorer wines, just as they would. Father typically received the seat of honor at Herod's right. He boasted of it often, though not as much as Mother, who seemed to think Father's power and glory extended to her. I glanced at Father, standing with Nathaniel, full of pompous expectation. How could he be so confident? His son had joined Antipas's enemies and committed public acts of treason. The entire city knew of his actions. I could not believe they would go completely unnoticed by the Tetrarch. Surely not. The sins of the son were visited on the father just as the father's sins were visited on the son. Hadn't Antipas once ordered his soldier to cut off the hand of a man whose son was a thief? Did Father truly think there would be no repercussion for him? It had perplexed me that Judas's rebellion had thus far yielded no apparent consequence to Father. It occurred to me now, however, that the Tetrarch would strike at Father unexpectedly, in a moment when he could inflict the most humiliation. Mother's face was strained with worry, and I could see she had the same thoughts as I. We watched the men being escorted to their places one by one, until only four places remained, the two seats of gloat beside Antipas, and the two seats of shame at the end. Left waiting were Father and Nathaniel and two men unknown to me. Shiny diadems of sweat had formed on the brows of the two strangers. Father, however, showed no sign of concern. With a nod to his palace steward, Chuzza, Antipas had Father and Nathaniel escorted to the seats of honor. Nathaniel clasped Father's arm, a gesture that seemed to celebrate the alliance the two of them had made. Father's power was intact. Their treaty was safe. I turned to Yaltha and saw her frown. The women dipped their bread and ate. They prattled and tossed back their heads and laughed, but I had no stomach for food or gaiety. Three musicians played the flute, cymbal, and Roman lyre, and a barefoot dancer no older than I leapt about with her brown breasts protruding like mushroom tops. Visit a pestilence upon my betrothal. Let it be broken by whatever means God chooses. Unbind me from Nathaniel Ben-Hanania. The curse I'd written formed lips of its own and repeated inside me. I no longer had faith God would hear it. Antipas lifted himself from the couch with some labor. The music ceased. The voices hushed. I saw Father smile to himself. Chuzza struck a little brass bell, and the Tetrarch spoke. Let it be known that my counselor and chief scribe, Matthias, has not rested in his search for my enemies. Today he delivered unto me two zealots, the most vicious of rebels, who have waged transgressions against my government and the government of Rome. He looked toward the doorway, raising his arm in dramatic fashion, pointing, and every guest turned in unison. There, bare-chested, his skin a bewilderment of whip marks and blood crust, stood Judas. His hands were bound, and he was cinched about his waist with a rope that was tied to that of a wild-eyed man I guessed to be Simon ben Gioras. I leapt to my feet, and my brother turned and found me. Little sister, he mouthed. Yaltha caught my arm as I bolted toward him, forcing me back onto the stool. There's nothing you can do but draw trouble on your own self, she whispered. Behold the traitors of Herod Antipas, called Chuzza, and a soldier led them stumbling into the room. It seemed they would be made into a sport for our entertainment. They were dragged full circuit about the banquet hall to the sound of my mother's crying. The men spewed abuses on them as they passed. I stared at my hands in my lap. The bell was rung again. The parade halted, and Antipas read from a scroll that I imagined my father had penned. On this day, the 19th of Marcheshvan, I, Herod Antipas, Tetrarch of Galilee and Perea, decree that Simon ben Gioras will be executed by sword for traitorous acts, and that Judas ben Matthias will be imprisoned at the fortress of Machaerus in Perea for the same offense, his life spared as a dispensation to his father, Matthias. It passed through my mind that my father had not acted as monstrously as I'd thought, that he'd delivered Judas into the hands of Antipas in order to save him from certain death. But I knew that was more wishful than true. Mother was slumped onto the table like a discarded cloak, her hair braid falling into a bowl of honeyed almonds. Just before Judas was led away, I looked at him, wondering if it would be my last glimpse. 25. A fever sickness descended on Sepphoris. It came like an unseen smoke, blown down from heaven to afflict the unrighteous. God had always chastised his people with plagues, fevers, leprosy, paralysis, and boils, so people said. But how could this be when the sickness bypassed Father and took hold of Yaltha? Lavi and I bathed her face with cool water, anointed her arms with oil, and sponged her lips with balm of Gilead. One night, when delirium took hold of her, She sat up in bed and clasped me to her, saying the name, Chaya, Chaya.
It's me, Anna, I told her.
But she smoothed her palm along my cheek and spoke the name again.
Chaya.
The name means life. Then I thought maybe in her feverish state, she was calling out for her life not to leave her, or perhaps she'd simply mistaken me for someone else. I dismissed the incident, but I didn't forget it. The entire city was closed up, tight as a fist. Father did not venture to the palace. Mother withdrew to her quarters. Shipra went around with a garland of hyssop around her neck, and Lavi kept a talisman of lion's hair in a pouch at his waist. Day and night I climbed onto the roof in quest of stars and rain and birdsong. There I witnessed the dead carried along the street to be laid in cave tombs beyond the city, where they would remain sealed until their flesh rotted and their bones were gathered into ossuaries. Keep out of God's sight, Mother cautioned me. As if in getting a glimpse of me on the roof, God would be reminded of my wrongdoings and strike me down with sickness too. Part of me wished for it. My guilt and sorrow over Judas was so grave, I wondered if my going to the roof wasn't really an attempt to contract the fever and die in order to escape my distress. The day after my disastrous betrothal ceremony, Judas left for the palace fortress in Macaris. Father announced his departure at the evening meal, then forbade Judas's name to be spoken again in his house. The war between my parents inhabited the house like a silent, prowling creature. Whenever Father left the room, my mother would walk to the threshold and spit on the place his foot had last fallen. She believed the fever would be God's retribution upon Antipas and Father. She waited for the Lord to smite them dead. She waited to no avail. Then one afternoon, a messenger arrived. We were seated on the couches in the reception hall, taking our midday meal, nothing more than dried fish and bread since Mother forbade Shipra and Lavi to venture out to the market. Nor would she allow the messenger into the house, ordering Lavi to receive his message at the door. When he returned, he cast a look at me I couldn't quite read.
Well, what is it? Mother said.
It is news from the house of Nathaniel ben Hananiah. He has fallen victim to the fever. My heart fluttered strangely. Then came an upwelling of relief and hope and gladness. I stared into my lap, afraid my feelings would blossom into my face. Glancing sideways at Mother, I watched her plunge her elbows onto the tripod table and drop her head into her hands. Father's face looked pale and grim. With a colluding glance at Yalfa, I rose from my couch and climbed the stairs to my room, closing the door behind me. I would have danced except for the guilt I felt over my happiness. When the same messenger arrived 2 weeks later with news that Nathaniel had survived, I wept into my pillow. Ever since the conversation with my aunt that had provoked my doubts, my old understanding of God had begun to fray. Now questions roiled inside me. Had God intervened to spare Nathaniel, ensuring my marriage to him? Or was his recovery merely a matter of luck and resilience? Had God caused my aunt's fever in order to chastise her, as my mother said? And when she too was restored, did it mean she'd repented? And Judas, had God willed him to be imprisoned by Herod Antipas? Why had he failed to save Tabitha? I could no longer believe in the God of punishments and rescues. When I was 9, I discovered God's secret name. I am who I am. I thought it was the truest, most wondrous name I'd ever heard. When my father overheard me speak it aloud, he shook my shoulders and forbade me to say the name ever again, for it was too holy to be uttered. I did not stop thinking of it, though, and during those days, when I questioned God's nature, I repeated the name over and over. I am who I am. 26. Phasaelis summoned me to the palace on the 4th of Tavet, unaware it was the 15th anniversary of my birth. A soldier had arrived at our gate well before noon, bearing her message written in Greek on a sheet of ivory hammered so thin it was like a peel of milk. I'd never seen a missive written on ivory. I took it in my hands. Light quivered on the black script, every word taut and perfect, and my old longing was ripped open. Oh, to write again, and on such a tablet! 4th of Tavet, Anna, I hope you have survived the fever and the confinement of these long and woeful weeks. I bid your presence at the palace. If you deem it safe, leave your cage this day and come to mine. We shall take the Roman baths and resume our friendship. Phasaelus. A shiver ran through me. Leave your cage. It had been a month and a half since the sickness had first appeared in the city. Only yesterday we'd heard of a child who'd become newly infected, but the disease seemed to be taking its leave. The funerary processions had nearly ceased, the market had reopened, father had resumed his business, and Yaltha, though still delicate, had left her bed. It was Friday. Sabbath would begin that evening. Nevertheless, mother, her eyes full of jealousy, gave me permission to visit the palace. The mosaic of sea creatures on the floor in the great hall was even more glorious in daylight. Phasaelus's silver-haired attendant, Joanna, left me staring at it while she went to seek her mistress. I had the feeling once again of standing on fishes, of waves moving beneath my feet, of the world reeling towards something I couldn't see. My husband's enthrallment with Roman mosaics has no beginning and no end, Phasaelus said. I had not seen her enter. I smoothed the folds of my pale yellow tunic and touched the amber bead at my neck, struck as I'd been before by the sight of her. She wore a brilliant blue robe and a string of pearls across her forehead. Her toenails were painted with campfire. It's beautiful, I said, letting my eyes sweep once more across the seafloor. Soon we will not have a tile left that hasn't been turned into an animal, a bird, or a fish. Does it concern the Tetrarch that he's violating the Jewish law against graven images? I don't know what made me ask such a thing. Maybe it came from my own brush with fear when I'd drawn the image of myself inside my incantation bowl. Whatever prompted it, my question was ill thought. She released a high, chirruping laugh. It would concern him only if he were caught. Though a Jew himself, he cares little for Jewish customs. It is Rome he lusts for. And you? You have no fears for him? Should a host of zealots drag my husband through the streets for breaking this law, it would not arouse the slightest care in me as long as they left the mosaics undamaged. I, too, find them beautiful. I would miss them more than I would miss Antipas. Her eyes snapped brightly. I tried to read her face. Beneath her easy indifference and her light-hearted dismissal of her husband lay something blistering. She said, even as the fever scourged the city and his subjects were dying, he commissioned a new mosaic. It will be even more flagrant than the rest of them. The artisan himself is afraid to create it. I could think of only one reason for such trepidation. It will depict a human form? She smiled. A face? Yes. A woman's face. We descended the steps onto the portico, then another set to the baths. A frail cloud of dampness floated up to us, the smell of wet stone and perfumed oils. Have you taken the Roman baths before? Phasaelus asked. I shook my head. I take them weekly. It's an elaborate and time-consuming ritual. They say the Romans indulge in them daily. If that's the case, one wonders when they found time to conquer the earth. In the changing room, we stripped naked except for towels, and I followed Phasaelus to the tepidarium, where the air flickered with lamps in high niches. We dipped in a pool of tepid water, then lay on stone-topped tables while two female attendants thrashed our arms and legs with olive branches and rubbed oil into our backs, kneading us like balls of dough. This odd ministration caused me to leave my body and sit on a little ledge just above my head, free of fret and fear. In the next room, however, I came hurtling back into myself. The hot vapors of the caldarium were so profuse, I struggled to breathe. We had entered the torments of Gehenna. I sat on the hard, slick floor, gripping my towel and rocking to and fro to keep myself from fleeing. Phasaelus, meanwhile, walked placidly through the mist unclothed, her hair falling around her knees, her breasts full as muskmelons. My own body, though 15, was still thin and boyish, my breasts like two brown figs. My forehead throbbed and my belly pitched. I don't know how long I waited through that small enduring, only that it made what came next a paradise. The most spacious of the bathing rooms, the frigidarium had curved bright walls with wide arches and bays bordered with vine-painted columns. Entering, I threw off my towel and plunged into the cold pool, then reclined on the bench that wrapped about the walls, sipping water and eating pomegranate seeds.
"It's here that Antipas intends to place his new mosaic," Phacelis said. She pointed to the tiles in the center of the room.
"Here? In the Frigidarium?"
"It's a room hidden from prying eyes, and it's his favorite room in the palace. When he entertains Anias, the Roman prefect, they spend all of their time in here conducting business, among other things."
The suggestive tone of her last sentence was somehow lost on me.
"I don't see why he wishes to install a woman's face here. Wouldn't fishes be more fitting?"
She smiled.
"Oh, Anna, you are still young and naive about the ways of men. They conduct their business here, it's true, but they also give way to other interests. Why do they wish a woman's face here? Because they are men."
I thought of Tabitha. I wasn't as naive about men as Phacelis thought.
A scraping sound came from the alcove behind us, the click of bracelets, then a low, guttering laugh. "So, you've been spying on us," Phacelis called out. She looked past me, over my shoulder, and I spun around, grabbing for my towel. Herod Antipas stepped from behind the arch. He fastened his gaze on me, his eyes moving from my face to my bare shoulders, then along the edges of the towel that barely covered my thighs. I swallowed, trying to force down my fear and disgust. Phacelis made no attempt to cover herself. She addressed me. "He sometimes watches me bathe. I should have warned you." Lascivious old man. Had he observed me step naked and dripping from the pool? Recognition flickered in his face. "You're the daughter of Matthias, the one we betrothed to Nathaniel ben Hanania. I didn't recognize you without your clothes."
He stepped toward me.
"Look at this face," he said to Phacelis, as if I were a sculpted object to be examined and discussed.
"Leave her be," she said.
"It's perfect. Large, well-spaced eyes. The high, plump cheeks. Look at her mouth. I've never seen a more beautiful one."
Coming closer, he slid his thumb along my lower lip. I glared at him.
"May you become crippled, blind, deaf, mute, and impotent."
His finger wound to my cheek, down to my neck. If I fled, what then? Would he send his soldiers after me? Would he do worse than rub his thumb across my face? I sat, unmoving. I would endure this, and then he would leave.
He said, "You will sit for my artisan so he can sketch your face."
Draping herself, Phacelis said, "You want her face for your mosaic?"
"Yes," he said. "It's young and pure. It suits me."
I sought his rodent eyes. "I will not allow my face to be in your mosaic."
"You will not allow? I'm your tetrarch. One day I will be called king, as my father was. I can force you, if I wish."
Phacelis stepped between us. "If you force her, you'll offend her father and her betrothed. But that's for you to decide. You are the tetrarch." I saw she was practiced at managing his caprices. He pressed his fingers together, seeming to consider what she'd said. In that brief interim, I wondered if I was to become visible in the world not through my writings, but through pieces of broken glass and marble. Could the vision I'd had of my face inside the tiny sun refer to a mosaic in Antipas's palace? As I gripped the edge of the bench, an idea came to me. I didn't stop to consider how it might turn into something unforeseen, even dangerous. I took a measured breath. "You may have my face for your mosaic, but on one condition. You must release my brother, Judas." He let loose a laugh that bounded off the walls. I glimpsed Phacelis tuck her chin and grin.
"You think I should release a criminal who plots against me only for the pleasure of seeing your face on the floor of my baths?"
I smiled.
"Yes, I do. My brother will be grateful and cease his rebellions. My parents will bless you, and the people themselves will call you blessed." It was those last words that snared him. He was a man despised by his people.
He craved to be named King of the Jews, a title that had belonged to his father, who'd ruled Galilee, Perea, and all of Judea. Antipas had been bitterly disappointed when his father carved up his kingdom into three portions for his sons and gave him a lesser part. Failing to get his father's blessing, he spent his days seeking the approval of Rome and the adoration of his people. He'd found neither. Phasaelus said, "She could be right, Antipas. Think of it. You could say that your clemency is a gesture of mercy for your people. It could turn their hearts. They will heap praise upon you." From my mother, I'd learned the skills of deception. I'd secreted my womanhood, hidden my incantation bowl, buried my writings, and feigned reasons to meet Jesus in the cave. But it was Father who'd shown me how to strike a despicable bargain. Antipas was nodding. Setting him free would be a magnanimous act on my part. It would be unexpected. A shock, perhaps, and that would draw even more attention to it. He turned to me. "I'll make the proclamation on the first day of the week, and the next day you will commence to sit for my artisan."
"I will sit for him when I've seen Judas with my own eyes, and only then."
27. Judas was delivered to our door 12 days after my visit to the palace. He arrived gaunt and dirty, with a sunken stomach, grime-matted hair, and pus-infested lash marks. His left eye was swollen into a slit, but his right eye contained a flame that hadn't been there before. Mother fell upon him, sniveling. Father stood apart, arms crossed over his chest. I waited for Mother's frantic attentions to cease and then took his hand.
"Brother," I said.
"You have your sister to thank for your release," Mother said. I'd had no choice but to tell my parents about the scheme I'd devised with the Tetrarch. I knew Antipas would speak of it to Father, but Judas had no need to be informed. I'd begged my parents to keep it from him. Father had shown little reaction to my arrangement with Antipas. He desired only to keep the Tetrarch happy, but Mother had been predictably jubilant. It was Yaltha, dear Yaltha, who'd kissed my cheeks and thought to worry about me.
"I fear for you, child," she'd said.
"Take care around Antipas. He's dangerous. Tell no one about the mosaic. It could be used against you." Judas stared at me with his one blinking eye while Mother expounded on the whole perverse story. "You would have your face mounted on the floor of a Roman bath for Herod Antipas and his cohorts to leer at?" he said. "I would rather you'd let me rot in Machaerus." The next day, Herod Antipas sent for me. I was made to sit on a low tripod stool in the frigidarium. The artisan used a string and a Phoenician measure to mark off a large circle at least 3 paces across, then set to work sketching my face on the floor with a finely sharpened stick of charcoal. He worked on his knees, his back hunched, painstakingly creating his pattern, sometimes wiping away the lines and starting again. He admonished me when I moved or sighed or shifted my eyes. Behind him, his workers hammered disks of glass into even-edged tesseri, red, brown, gold, and white, each one the size of a baby's thumbnail. The artisan was young, but I saw his talent. He filled the borders with braided leaves and here and there a pomegranate. He would sit back and tilt his head to study his work so that his cheek lay nearly on his shoulder. And when he drew my head, it tilted too, but slightly. He sketched a garland of leaves in my hair and drop pearl earrings at my ears, none of which I was wearing. A chimera of a smile played on my lips. My eyes bore the faint suggestion of something sensual. For 3 days he worked while I sat, hours and hours, while all around us the endless tap-tap-tapping of mallets. On the 4th day he sent a servant to inform Herod Antipas the sketch was completed. When the Tetrarch arrived to inspect it, the hammering ceased and the workers shrank against the wall. The artisan, racked with nerves, sweating and fidgety, awaited judgment. Antipas circled the sketch with his fingers laced behind his back, looking from the sketch to me, as if judging the likeness. "You've captured her with precision," he told the artisan. He walked to where I sat on the stool and stood over me. There was a raw and frightening light in his face. He cupped his hand around my breast and squeezed hard. He said, "The beauty of your face makes me forget your lack of breasts." I looked up at him, at the girth of him, at the lust in his eyes, and I could barely see for the rage I felt, for the way it turned everything white and blinding. I sprang up, my hands lashing out. I shoved him once, twice. My reaction was spontaneous, but not unconsidered. Even as he'd reached out to hurt me, even as the pain twisted in the little mound of flesh around my nipple, I told myself I would not sit there willing myself to be small and imperceptible as I had that day he'd smeared his thumb across my lips. I shoved him a third time. He was like a stone, unmoved. I thought he would strike me. Instead, he smiled, showing his pointy teeth. He leaned toward me. "So you're a fighter. I'm fond of women who fight," he whispered. "Especially in my bed." He strode away. No one spoke, and then all at once the workers let out small gasps and murmurs. With relief, the artisan acknowledged he had no more need of me. Now they would mix the plaster and lay the bright tesserae, immortalizing me in a mosaic on which I hoped never to lay eyes. Phaselis had been kind to me, and I would miss her, but I vowed when I left the palace this day, I would never return. As I departed, Joanna waylaid me in the great hall. "Phaselis wishes to see you." I went to her room, glad for the chance to tell my friend goodbye. She reclined at a low table, engaged in a game of knucklebones. "Seeing me," she said, "I've had a meal prepared for us in the garden." I hesitated. I wished to be far away from Herod Antipas. "Just us, alone?" She read my thought. "Don't fear. Antipas would think it beneath him to dine with women." I was not so sure of it, not if it provided him an opportunity to grasp a breast, but I accepted her hospitality, not wanting to offend her. The garden was a portico surrounded by t-shirt trees. Babylon willows and juniper bushes bowed over with pink flowers. Reclining on couches, we dipped our bread in common bowls, and I drank in the bright light. After so many hours in the dark frigidarium, the shock of it raised my spirits. Phaselis said, "Herod Antipas's proclamation freeing Judas has made him faintly popular among the people. He even spared the life of Simon ben Gioras, though he kept him imprisoned. At least now his subjects don't spit quite as far when they hear his name." She laughed, and I thought how much I loved to see her snicker at her own wicked humor. She went on. "The Romans, however, were unamused. Annius sent a legate from Caesarea to express his disapproval. I overheard Antipas trying to explain that such gestures were needed from time to time to keep the rabble in check. He sent Annius assurances that Judas would no longer be a threat." I didn't want to think of Antipas, nor of Judas. Since returning, my brother had spent his time tending his wounds and gathering his strength. He'd spoken not a word to me since learning of the mosaic. Phaselis added, "But we both know, don't we, that Judas is more of a threat now than before?" "Yes," I said, "far more." I watched a white ibis pick at the ground, and I thought of the white sheet of ivory she'd sent to me, of its bold, exquisite script. "Do you remember the invitation you sent, inviting me to leave my cage and come to yours? I've never seen a more beautiful tablet." "Ah, the ivory leaves. They're the only ones of their kind in all of Galilee." "Where did you come upon them?" "Tiberius sent a parcel of them to Antipas some months ago. I took one of them for myself."
"And did you write the invitation yourself?"
"Are you surprised that I write?"
"Only at the power of your script. Where did you learn it?"
"When I first arrived in Galilee, I spoke only Arabic, but I couldn't read or write it. I missed my father terribly, despite him sending me away. It was always in my mind to return to him. I set out to learn Greek so I could write to him. It was your father who taught me."
"My father." The revelation cut through me.
"Did he teach you also?" she asked.
"No, but he brought me inks and papyrus from time to time."
That sounded self-pitying and meager. I wanted to believe that teaching her Greek was what had softened father to my own desire to read and write, why he'd given in to my pleadings despite mother's disapproval, why he'd hired Titus as my tutor. But it didn't change the envy that had surfaced from some old, deep place. Then, as if we'd conjured him, my father was limping toward us on the portico. His feet dragged as if shackled. His eyes were cast down. Phaselis, too, studied him. Something was wrong. I sat up and waited for what would come.
May I speak freely?
He asked Phaselis. When she nodded, he eased onto the couch beside me, grunting like an old man, and up close I saw that it was not only sadness on his face, but a quiet infuriation. He looked plundered, as if he'd lost the thing dearest to him. He said, Nathaniel recovered from the fever sickness, but it left him weakened. It is my burden to tell you, Anna. He died this day, while walking in his date grove. I said nothing. I know the betrothal was a yoke for you, he continued, but now your condition is worse. You will be treated as a widow. He shook his head. Yours is a stigma we will all bear. In the curve of my ear, I heard the rush of wings. I saw the ibis lift away. 28. In the aftermath of Nathaniel's death, I was required to wear a robe the color of ash and go about with bare feet. Mother put dust on my head and fed me the bread of affliction and complained that I did not cry with loud and bitter wails or rend my clothes. I was a 15-year-old widow. I was free. Free, free, free! I would not enter the huppah with despair and dread over what my husband would do to me. The cloth of virginity would not be placed beneath my hips and paraded around afterward for witnesses to inspect. Instead, when the 7 days of mourning ended, I would beg Father to let me resume my writing. I would go to the cave and dig up the incantation bowl and the goatskin stuffed with my scrolls. At night, when I lay still in my bed, the knowledge of these things would break over me and I would laugh deep into my pillow. I assured myself the curse I'd written played no part in Nathaniel's dying, but still, my jubilation often brought on bouts of guilt. I rebuked myself for rejoicing in his death, I truly did, but I would not have wished him back. Oh, blessed widowhood! At his burial, I walked with his sister Zophar and his two daughters at the forefront of a throng of mourners as we accompanied Nathaniel's body to the family's cave. His linen shroud had been poorly wrapped, and when he was carried to the cave entrance, the hem of it snagged on a thorn bush. It necessitated a laborious effort to extricate him. It gave the impression of Nathaniel fighting his internment, and it struck me as comical. I pressed my lips together, but the smile broke through, and I saw Nathaniel's daughter, Marta, not much younger than I, glare at me with hatred. Afterward, at the funeral banquet, remorseful that she'd observed my amusement, I said, I'm sorry you've lost your father. But you are not sorry you lost your betrothed, she snapped and turned away. I ate the roasted lamb and drank the wine, unconcerned that I'd made an enemy. 29. On the first day of mourning, Mother found a tablet at her door inscribed in Judas's hand. Not able to read it herself, she sought me out and thrust the message at me. What does it say? My eyes flowed over his terse script. I can remain no longer in my father's house. He has no wish for me here, and while Simon Ben-Gioras is imprisoned, the zealots have need of a leader. I will do what I can to rally their spirits. I pray you will not blame me for departing. I do what I must. I bid you well, your son, Judas. Then, set apart at the bottom, Anna, you did your best for me. Be wary of Herod Antipas. With Nathaniel gone, may you be free. I read it aloud to her. She walked away, leaving the tablet in my hands. That same day, Mother dismissed the spinners and weavers who'd spent the past 2 weeks creating garments for my dowry. I watched as she folded the tunics, robes, shifts, girdles, and headscarves and stacked them in the chest of cedar that had once held my writings. Atop the clothes, she placed the bridal dress, smoothing her hands over it before closing the lid. Her eyes were wellsprings. Her lower lip trembled. I couldn't determine whether her sorrow was over Nathaniel's death or Judas's departure. I regretted my brother leaving, but I felt no anguish over it. I'd expected it, and he'd made peace with me in his note. I stood there trying to look impassive, but Mother sensed my gladness over Nathaniel, how it made a small brightness on my skin. You think you've escaped a great misfortune, she said, but your tribulation has only begun.
Few men, if any, will want you now.
This she thought to be a tribulation.
Her misery had been so great since learning of Nathaniel's death, it was a miracle she hadn't shaved her head and dressed in sackcloth. Father, too, had gone about withdrawn and glum, not over the loss of his friend, but over the forfeiture of their bargain and the land he would never own. Feeling pity for Mother, I said, I know men are reluctant to marry a widow, but I can only be counted as one by the strictest of interpretations. I'm a girl whose betrothed has died, that's all. She was on her knees beside the chest. She got to her feet and lifted one brow, always a poor sign. Even of those girls, men say, do not cook in a pot in which your neighbor has cooked. I flushed. Nathaniel did not cook in my pot. Last evening at the banquet, Nathaniel's own daughter, Marta, was heard to say you'd lain with her father in his house. But that's a falsehood. I minded little if betrothed couples lay together. It happened often enough. Some men even claimed it was their right to lay with the woman to whom they were already legally bound. What I minded was the lie. Mother laughed, a throat rattle of condescension. If you had not despised Nathaniel so thoroughly, I might believe the girl's words to be true. But it doesn't matter what I think, only what others believe. The gossipmonger saw you roaming all over the city, even beyond the walls. Your father was stupid to permit it. Even after I confined you again to the house, you slipped out. I myself heard people talk of your roving. The men and women of Sepphoris have spent weeks speculating over your virginity, and now this girl, Marta, has thrown a log on their fire. I waved my hand at her. Let them think what they will. Anger seared across her face, then fell away, bit by bit, in little crumbles. In the sullen gray light of my room, her shoulders sagged, her eyes closed. She seemed very tired. Don't be unwitting, Anna. Being a widow is deterrent enough, but if you're also thought to be defiled— Her voice trailed off into the doom and gloom of having a husbandless daughter. I thought of Jesus then, that day in the cave, rain-soaked hair, the crook of his grin, the ragged portion of bread he offered, the things he said while the storm raged. It caused a tipping over in my stomach, but perhaps he would not have me now either. Husbands may be loathsome creatures, she was saying, but they're necessary. Without their protection, women are easily mistreated. Widows can even be cast out. The young ones resort to harlotry, the old ones to beggary. Like Sophocles, my mother was capable of tragic sweeps of imagination. Father will not cast me out, I told her. He takes care of Yaltha, who's a widow. Do you think he would not take care of me, his daughter? He won't always be here. He too will die, and what will happen to you then? You cannot inherit.
If father dies, you will be a widow as well. Who will care for you? You cannot inherit either.
She sighed. My care will fall to Judas.
And you think he would not provide for me or for Yaltha?
I don't think he will be able to provide for any of us, she answered. He does nothing but seek trouble. Who can say what means Judas will have? Your fool of a father has disclaimed him. He went so far as to write his own disownment into a contract. Now, on his death, this house and everything in it will go to his brother, Haran. I took a moment to grasp the magnitude of what she was saying. Haran had cast out Yaltha once. He wouldn't hesitate to cast her out again, along with me and Mother. A wave of fear passed through me. Our lives and fates left to men. This world, this God-forsaken world. From the corner of my eye, I saw Yaltha standing in the doorway. Had she heard? Mother spied her as well and left us. As my aunt stepped inside, I took a mocking tone. I didn't wish her to see how Mother's words had disturbed me. It seems the entire populace has picked over the state of my virginity like a flock of scavengers and has determined it's missing. I've become a mamzer. Mamzers were of all varieties. Bastards, harlots, adulterers, fornicators— thieves, necromancers, beggars, lepers, divorced women, cast-out widows, the unclean, the destitute, those possessed of devils, Gentiles, all of them shunned accordingly. Yaltha wove her fingers through mine. I've been without a husband for many years. I will not mislead you, child. You will live even further on the outskirts now. I've spent my life there. I know the uncertainty Hadar spoke about, and now that Haran will inherit the house, our fates are threatened even more. But we shall be all right, you and I. Will we, Aunt?
She tightened the hitch of her fingers. The day you met Nathaniel in the market, you returned home bereft. And that night, I came to your room. I told you your moment would come. I thought Nathaniel's death would be that moment, a portal I could step through and find some measure of freedom. But now it seemed his dying would only leave me scorned, and my future would leave me destitute. Seeing my dejection, Yaltha added, "Your moment will come, because you'll make it come." Even though my window was boarded over until the spring, I went and stood before it. Cold air seeped around the wood panel. I felt incapable of making any moment come that would change my circumstance for the better. The longing of my heart was for a man I scarcely knew. It was buried with my bowl and my writings. God, too, was hidden from me now. Behind me, Yaltha spoke. "I told you how I came to be rid of my husband, Rubel, but not how I came to marry him. We went to sit among the bedpillows, which only a short time ago had been plump with my laughter. Settling herself, she said, "On the 15th of Ab, the Jewish girls in Alexandria, the ones who were not yet betrothed, the ones with little appeal, went into the vineyards during the grape harvest and danced for the men in need of brides. We went late in the day before the sunset, all of us wearing white dresses and bells sewn on our sandals, and the men would be there, waiting. You should have seen us. We were scared, clinging to one another's hands. We carried drums and danced in a single line that moved like a serpent through the vines." She paused in the telling, and I could see it clearly. The sky singed red, the girls twittering with apprehension, the sway of white dresses, the long, serpentine dance. As she resumed her story, her eyes seemed to darken at the edges. I danced each year for 3 years, until finally someone chose me. Rubel. I wanted to cry, not for myself, but for her. How would a girl know she was chosen? The man would come and ask her name. Sometimes he would go to her father that very night, and the contract would be drawn. Could she refuse? Yes, but it was rare. She would not risk displeasing her father. "You didn't refuse," I said. This both captivated and dismayed me. How different her life might have been. "No, I didn't refuse. I didn't have the courage." She smiled at me. "We make our moments, Anna, or we do not." Later, alone in my room, the house deep in slumber, I removed the white marriage dress from the chest, and with the snipping knife, I cut the hem and the sleeves into long tatters. I slipped it on and crept from the house. The air caused cold scintillas of flesh to rise on my arms. I mounted the ladder to the roof and climbed like a night vine, the shreds of my dress fluttering. A small wind stirred the dark, and I thought of Sophia, the very breath of God in the world, and I whispered to her, "Come, lodge in me, and I will love you with all my heart and mind and soul." Then on the roof, as close to the sky as I could get, I danced. My body was a reed pen. It spoke the words I couldn't write. I danced not for men to choose me, nor for God. I dance for Sophia. I dance for myself. 30. When the 7 days of mourning ended, I walked through the center of Sepphoris with my parents and aunt to synagogue. Father had been reluctant for us to appear in public so soon. Rumors about my missing virginity blanketed the city like rotted manna, but mother believed a demonstration of my devoutness would soften the vitriol toward me. "We must show the entire population we bear no shame," she said. "Otherwise, they'll believe the worst." I can't imagine why father went along with such stupid reasoning. It was a clear, cool day, the air oiled with the smell of olives, everyone in their woolen cloaks. It didn't seem like the kind of day trouble would find us. Nevertheless, father had ordered Antipas's soldier to traipse behind us. Yaltha didn't usually come with us to synagogue, which was a relief to my parents as well as my aunt, but here she was today, adhered to my side. We walked without speaking, as if holding our breath. We wore no splendor. Even mother was clad in her simplest dress. "Keep your head bowed low," she told me when we first set out. But I found now I couldn't do it. I walked with my chin lifted and my shoulders back, the tiny sun perched over me, trying very hard to shine. As we neared the synagogue, the street grew crowded. Spotting our subdued little entourage and then me in particular, the people halted their progress, clumped together, and stared. A swell of muttering rose up. Yaltha leaned close to me.
Fear nothing, she said.
She's the one who laughed at the death of her betrothed, Nathaniel Ben-Hanania, someone shouted. Then another voice that sounded vaguely familiar cried, Harlot!
We kept walking. I kept my eyes straight ahead as if not hearing.
Fear nothing.
She's possessed by devils. She's a fornicator.
The soldier waded into the crowd, scattering it, but like some dark, slippery creature, it reformed on the other side of the street. People spit as I passed. I smelled the shame streaming off my parents. Yaltha took my hand as the familiar voice came again.
The girl is a harlot!
This time I turned and found the accuser, the round, bulbous face. Tabitha's mother. 31. I waited 3 weeks before approaching Father. I was patient and, yes, sly. I continued to wear my grim gray dress, though it was no longer required, and when Father was about, I made myself downcast and dutiful. I rubbed my eyes with bitter herbs, a speck of horseradish or tansy, turning them red-rimmed and watery. I poured oil on his feet while swearing my purity and bemoaning the stigma brought upon my family. I served him honeyed fruit. I called him blessed. Finally, on a day Father appeared amiable, at an hour Mother was nowhere near, I knelt before him.
I will understand if you refuse me, Father, but I beg you to let me return to my writing and my studies while I wait and hope for another betrothal. I only wish to keep occupied so I'm not consumed with dismay at the sad state I'm in.
He smiled, pleased with my humility. I'll grant you 2 hours each morning to read and write, but no more. The rest of the day, you will do as your mother wishes. As I bent to kiss his foot, I drew back and wrinkled my nose at the smell of his freshly made sandal. It caused him to laugh. He placed his hand on my head, and I saw that he felt at least something for me, something between pity and affection. He said, I will bring you some clean papyri from the palace. I removed my mourning dress, immersed myself in the mikveh, and donned a tunic without pattern or dye and an old tanned coat. I wove a single white ribbon into my braid and covered my head with a scarf that was once as blue as the sky, but now washed of its color. It was shortly past daybreak when I set out to the cave, slipping through the back gate with a small digging tool and a large pouch strapped to my back containing bread, cheese, and dates. I'd determined not to be without my writings and my bowl any longer. I would hide them in Lavi's quarters if I must, but I would have them near me, and surely soon I could blend them among the new scrolls I would write, and my parents would not suspect I had saved them from being burned. My mind overflowed with new narratives I would compose, beginning with those of Tamer, Dinah, and the unnamed concubine. I had ventured out without Lavi or concern for what vicious tongues would say. Everything had already been said. Shipra returned each day from the market, eager to impart the tales she'd heard of my depravity, and when Mother or I went out, people of our own standing hurled imaginative insults. The kinder ones merely turned away from us on the street. When I reached the city gate, I looked toward Nazareth. The valley floors ran wild with coriander, dill, and mustard, and already workers were making their way to building sites in the city. I wondered if I might find Jesus praying at the cave. I'd timed my trip well for seeing him. The sun's pink fingers were still wrapped around the clouds. It was close to the end of Shavuot, when the almond trees blossomed. The wakeful tree, we called it. Midway down the hill, I smelled its rich brown scent, and winding farther, I came upon the tree itself, its canopy lush with white flowers. I stepped beneath it, thinking of the marriage canopy I'd escaped, of my dance on the rooftop, that choosing of myself. I plucked one of the small white flowers and tucked it over my ear. Jesus stood at the cave entrance with his fringed cloak pulled over his head and his arms lifted in prayer. Drawing near, I placed my tool and pouch on a rock and waited. My heart pounded. For a moment, it was as if everything that had come before did not matter. His prayer was whispered, but over and over again, I heard him address God as Abba, Father. When he finished, he pulled his cloak back around his shoulders. I walked toward him with my chin set, with no falter in my step. I didn't recognize myself, the young woman with the almond blossom in her hair. I called out, Shilama, I fear I've intruded upon you.
He paused, taking me in. Then came the smile. We are on level pegging, then. When we met before, I was the one who intruded on you.
I feared he might leave. There was no rain to detain him this time. A little intoxicated by my audacity, I said, Please be kind enough to share my meal. I don't wish to eat alone.
Last time he'd proved to be a man who interpreted the law liberally, open-minded about interacting with women and Gentiles. But an unbetrothed man and woman alone on a hillside without a chaperone was a forbidding matter. The Pharisees, those who prayed loudly only to be heard and wore phylacteries twice as large as normal, would think it a reason to throw stones at us. Even those less pious might say such a meeting bound the man to ask the girl's father for a betrothal contract. I watched him waver for several moments before he accepted. We sat in a puddle of sunlight near the cave mouth and broke bread, wrapping it about small hunks of cheese. We nibbled the dates and spit the pits and talked haltingly of small, heedless things. Throughout, he lifted his hand to shield his face from the glare and glanced toward the path through the balsam grove. When a long and awful silence fell over us, I made up my mind. I would speak as I wished to speak, say what I wanted to say.
You call God Father? I asked. Referring to God in that way was not unheard of, but it was unusual.
After pausing, perhaps out of surprise, he said,
The practice is new to me. When my father died, I felt his absence like a wound. One night in my grief, I heard God say to me, I will be your father now.
God speaks to you?
He stifled a grin.
Only in my thoughts.
I've just observed my own time of mourning, I said. My betrothed died 5 weeks ago. I refused to lower my eyes, but I kept the gladness from reaching them.
I'm sorry, he said. Am I right to think he was the rich man in the market?
Yes, Nathaniel ben Hanania. I was made to go to the market that day by my parents. It was the first time I'd ever seen Nathaniel. You must have witnessed my revulsion for him. I regret I showed no subtlety, but a betrothal to him felt like dying. I was given no choice.
Silence, but this time it lit upon us like something winged. He watched my face. The earth hummed. I saw his body sigh and the last of his inhibitions fall away.
You've suffered much, he said, and it seemed he spoke of more than my betrothal.
I got to my feet and stepped into the shadow that edged the cave opening. I'd been deceitful with him before, and I didn't wish to be so again. I would have him know the worst.
I cannot be unfair to you, I said. You should know with whom you speak.
Since Nathaniel's death, I've become a scourge to my family. In Sepphoris, I'm a pariah. It's falsely rumored that I'm a fornicator. And because I'm the daughter of Herod Antipas's chief scribe and counselor, it has become a grand and notorious scandal. When I leave our house, people cross the road to avoid me. They spit at my feet. They shout, harlot. I wanted to protest my innocence further, but couldn't bring myself to do so. I waited to see if he would withdraw, but he rose, coming to stand with me in the thin shade, his expression unchanged.
The ways of people can be cruel, he said.
Then quieter. You're not alone in this suffering.
Not alone.
I met his eyes, trying to understand his meaning, and I saw again how everything floated there.
He said, You should know with whom you speak as well. I am also a Mamzer. In Nazareth, some say I'm Mary's son, not Joseph's. They say I was born from my mother's fornication. Others say my father is Joseph, but that I was illicitly conceived before my parents married. I've lived all 20 years of my life with this stigma.
My lips parted, not in surprise at what he'd said, but that he'd chosen to divulge it to me.
You're shunned still? I asked.
As a boy, I wasn't allowed in synagogue school until my father went and pleaded with the rabbi. When he was alive, he shielded me from gossip and slights. Now that he's gone, it's made worse. I believe it's why I can find no work in Nazareth.
He'd been rubbing the hem of his sleeve between his fingers as he talked, and he let go now, straightening. but that is as it is. I only mean to say, I know the pain you speak of. He appeared uncomfortable that he'd turned the conversation to himself, but I couldn't cease my questions. How have you endured their scorn for so long? I tell myself their hearts are boulders and their heads are straw. He laughed. Lashing out at them did no good. As a boy, I was always coming home scraped and bloodied from some fight. You'll think me soft compared to other men, but now when I'm reviled, I try to look the other way. It does the world no good to return evil for evil. I try now to return good to them instead. What manner of person is this? Men would think him weak, yes. Women, too. But I knew the strength it took to forego striking back. He began to pace. I could sense some stirring inside him. So many suffer this kind of contempt, he said.